5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Season 4 of the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
This podcast is all about elite distance running in the UK.
We're here to give you all the latest news updates around the sport,
as well as weekly interviews with athletes and coaches.
Stay up to date by following us on Instagram and X at Sunday Podcast.
And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel too, where we post athlete workout videos, shoe reviews and more.
Thanks for listening, and as always, we hope you enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome back to another episode. As you can see from the title, Mr. Adam Spencer on the podcast this weekend. Just if you're not sure, we're recording Friday, 7th of June, 10 a.m. UK time. This guy goes in the NCAA 1500 meter final tonight. We are banking that you're going to have an NCAA 1500 meter champion on the pod this week. So hopefully all the best to Mr. Spencer. But obviously you guys will know whether he's a champ or not, already the Australian champ, 331 PB, which for a 22-year-old in the NCAA, it's ridiculous, isn't it, man?
It's indeed, man. And yeah, I think he's going to win tonight. I watched his heat yesterday morning, and he just looked, and even his like prelim rounds as well, the NCAA regionals, and it's like he's not doing anything special. He's kind of just flying under the radar a little bit and gassing up like this Colin Salmon and, you know, the Washington boys and stuff like that. But yeah, I think he's definitely going to be one to watch. I think hopefully, fingers crossed, we've timed it to perfection, mate, and we've got him on the week he wins the NCAAs. So yeah, but I think we just on his episode, we learned a thing or two about the Neil deal. He actually broke that down for us. I thought that was quite interesting. So enjoy that and his situation, because the NCAA is not a weird place at the moment, but with these Neil deals, and athletes just getting paid a salary plus a full scholarship, it's arguably the best place that any athlete could be right now, because the support network, the group that you're going to be training with, the coaching, the environment, like I don't see why any athlete would choose to leave the NCAA given some of their setups. And so I think you're going to have athletes who are a lot older in the NCAA, like athletes staying on as long as possible, potentially. And then as well, I just think you're going to get athletes carrying out their all kind of 4 or 5 years of eligibility, aren't you? As opposed to trying to rush to turn pro at any point. So the standard of the NCAA now is, I mean, we know it's been getting better, but like, I think it's only going to get better and better and better as well. And it's going to be borderline like one of the best, kind of, although it's not considered professional, one of the best circuits in the world.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, mate. I think as we know, the only kind of drawback of the NCAA is stretching out your season from kind of having to peak in June to then trying to go to a major champs, for example, in August. But apart from that, look, we see it with the other American sports, you know, like collegiate football, American football, that is, and obviously basketball is almost bigger than the NFL and the NBA in terms of following, at least. So they're absolutely massive. The sports and for athletes of that sort of age, like up to maybe even like 25, probably you're getting people now sort of staying on. Adam Spencer obviously still only 22, but yeah, there's not many better opportunities, is there?
Not at all. I do think, yeah, given if you're a sort of 16, 17 year old in the UK right now as well, I think, you know, you look at that and you think, Jesus, this is a realistic place for me to really give things a crack. And if you can sign a nil deal by the time you're sort of in your third, fourth year in college, not to say that that's all athletes should be targeting, but it definitely, I guess, allows you for a bit of an easier transition into a senior athlete, because I think that is something that international athletes in the NCAA struggled with. Like, always the American athletes in the NCAA, they had high stock, like you knew they were going to be able to go pro. But English athletes, I think, or, you know, just foreign athletes in general, it was like, you know, obviously the sport isn't as rich in their home countries and stuff like that, and they would potentially walk away with like quite naff contracts, or if any contracts at all. Whereas I feel like with these nil deals, I mean, Bizimana's a guy who signed one, hasn't he? I mean, he went on, so, you know, he's almost like banked on a professional contract before finishing college. I think that's a nice position for athletes to be in. Just takes the stress off them a little bit going into their final year and stuff. So, yeah, big movements there, mate. But we'll let people enjoy the episode. And we'll let people hopefully enjoy watching it as well. I think all the NCAA races go up on YouTube pretty much the morning after. So when we wake up Saturday morning, they'll be there to watch. And same as Sunday, when people are listening, they can watch the women's finals. Obviously, Euros is taking place at the moment, so we won't. It's kicking off today, so we won't talk too much about the European champs. We'll come out with a big review episode next weekend and really break that down. And of course, then I think we start to shape up trials as well and start to talk about those Olympic spots. But the big news this week, mate, was this World Athletics Ultimate Championship.
Well, yeah, that was the big news, and not much else to talk about apart from that, really. And Matt, you've already kind of voiced some of your concerns on the Instagram page, and had a few interesting discussions off the back of that. Talk about what this actually is, because I know you've done a bit more reading than I have around kind of what this champs actually potentially looks like.
Well, look, there isn't even heaps of information coming out about it, you know. In short, they're just going to hold like basically a mini world champs in 2026. And from what I've read as well, you know, they make out like it's something they want to include in the off year. That off year they talk about between Worlds and Olympic Games. But then they want this championship, if I read right, is going to be taking place every 2 years. So that means this championship will be taking place on the Olympic year in 2028. So that is definitely not an off year. You've also got European championships and stuff as well. So, yeah, it's a bit weird. And I'd be really interested to see how it fares in sort of 2028 and how it takes off. But you know, it's a three-day championship. They want to do short kind of three-hour sessions. Basically, it's the Diamond League final. Those who have watched the Diamond League final in previous years, where they've done Saturday, Sunday, Zurich and Brussels, and it's been 2 hours of action each night. It is pretty much that. 8 athletes in the field events, 16 athletes in the track events. The only difference is they're going to have a semi-final for the track events. So, for example, you know, that 100 meters, there's going to be 2 heats, and then they'll just have 8 athletes in the final. They have stated as well, classic, like the marquee events will be there. I don't know what they class as the marquee events, but not all disciplines will be at this championship. So, again, basically, they're doing
what they... relays.
Bank on a load of relays, yep. But they're kind of doing what they did a few years ago, where they were just slashing events from the Diamond League, and which kind of, you know, and then they kind of reversed that decision because there was uproar. But yeah, we don't know what these events are going to be. But I question, if you're cutting events, how is this meeting going to take bloody 3 hours? 3 days of 3 hours, like. Not being funny, you shouldn't take that long if you're only having a few events there as well. But yeah, and then that's the big thing as well. They talk about the prize money, and this is an interesting one for me, because they go, we're going to put on a brand new championship. We're going to give out $10 million worth of prize money. The winners are going to get $150,000, which I think if you do the maths, and kind of follow a Diamond League format, it means second place is going to get $60,000 and so on, because they say everyone's going to walk away with some prize money. So I saw someone kind of break it down and say, well, this is what $10 million split up between 400 athletes could look like, etc. So, I mean, there's that. But I was just thinking, why don't they just take that money? Because I don't know how many millions that event is going to cost to put on in general. Or maybe the World Athletics profit. I don't know. But even that $10 million worth of prize money that they're going to dish out, why don't they just go, well, hold on. If we just add that to the current World Championships, instead of $80,000 for winning the World Championships, well, we can just, you know, plug a bit more money into the current World Championships and give athletes $120,000 for winning, or $150,000 for winning, or whatever sort of allowance they would have left over. So, and then just make
the
that.
The problem is, Matt, that's not going to save track and field. So what's the point?
You know? I just feel like it's another case of like, they haven't actually fixed, like they say they want something which is going to bring young fans in, more engaging fans. I'm like, literally got the World Championships, like surely tweak that, make that better. So they're basically saying they don't like the World Championship format, and it even comes down to athletes are going to be wearing national colors, you know, national kit instead of their individual sponsors as well. And I'm just like, well, a governing body's going to get involved, like what is this about? So it's just a mini World Champs, and yeah, it's just all a bit odd. I don't feel it has a purpose at all, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it does seem a bit weird, doesn't it? Especially like to announce it now for 2026. Like obviously that people might say, oh, that is quite a while away, but actually I think you need to announce something like that a long time before, so that people can really sort of prepare. Like we know what athletes are like. They're meticulous about how they prepare over years, not just season to season. I mean, people need to know exactly what it is and what it's going to look like with plenty of time to go. Like, I'm not being funny. You could just, if they wanted to, like they're in charge of their own governing body. Like they could just have the World Champs 3 years out of four, if that's what they want to do, like a proper World Champs. Or if this is better, all the World Champs be like this. If they're saying this is actually a superior World Champs, then do that for all of them. You know, if they're saying that's a good format, for example. How's this going to fit in with the Michael Johnson Track League? You know, because that's the next big thing, as we all know. When are Netflix coming in? Are they going to cover this? Who knows, mate? Who knows? I don't know. I feel like I just, for me anyway, like the Olympics is still always going to be the pinnacle. And like, I just think like World Athletics need to do more to promote the Olympics. Like, I know they're not in control of it necessarily, but they do have a certain amount of influence over it. And they could be cashing in this year by kind of trying to attract more fans to the Olympics, like helping out the Olympic Committee or whoever it is who sorts those kind of schedules out and that sort of thing, to try and have more control over it, because it's still going to be the flagship event.
It's all pretty political though, isn't it? You know, two completely different organizations. But you are right. I mean, what's an athlete going to value more? Like, it's going to get awfully confusing when we're like, oh, hold on a sec. This person's a World Athletics Ultimate Champion, which to me, that sounds like a bigger deal than the World Champ. So it's just going to get a bit confusing. And then also you're going to a competition where like the person who's won the World Athletics Ultimate Champion Chips, they've won more prize money as well. And so again, that's kind of like, it's looking like that is going to be a bigger deal. What's going to be meaning more to an athlete than the World Champs? And as well, like, I just think when you have two things with a very similar name and a very similar dynamic, you are one is going to be worse off. There will be a knock-on effect. So it will either be that, at, you know, big time names will look at the World Champs and go, that's not quite as big. I'm going to target this Ultimate Championships, or vice versa. You know, athletes are going to sack off that Ultimate Championships. I mean, it's in September as it is anyway. But I don't know. I mean, of course, I think athletes will go to it. It's a big payday for them. But as for saying, will fans get engaged in it? just sounds like a diamond league to me. And I actually don't like races where athletes are handpicked beforehand as well. And it's going to be done on ranking. And we think world ranking, but I mean, that doesn't really come into play because the top 16 in the world, it'll just be on times anyway. And you can have multiple people from the same country. One thing which is so special about the Olympics and the World Champs is like no one can predict that final.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that final, I guess you can kind of predict the top three, but it's a lot more difficult. And that's what's exciting. Like the Diamond League, when you see the start list beforehand and it's not as exciting. But anyway, man, yeah, there's that. And I do think it is a response to this Michael Johnson track league, because I think they're very worried about that gaining momentum and athletes starting to prioritize that, especially when we talk about in these off years and the money that they might bring. And I think World Athletics want a grip of it. But again, I mean, you talk about bringing fans in, how confusing is it going to be in 2026 when there's eight different competitions going on, or 2028 when there's about eight different competitions going on, Euros, Olympics, this silly championships and Michael Johnson's championships.
Oh dear. Who knows, mate, to be honest, what it's going to look like. We can only speculate. So yeah, just a disclaimer, we're not experts on this at all. Well, Matt might be. I know he's been deep in.
I don't think anyone can be. No one knows enough to be an expert on this. Like there's just, all you can read is a small articles here and there. You can listen to a few interviews with Seb Coe, but it's obviously just in its early phases. So we actually don't know much. It might be amazing.
Mm. Yeah, it might be. And then maybe, like I said, I think if it is amazing, you need to take that format and that just needs to be all worlds, there's no point in having multiple world champs. It reminds me of what absolutely grates me about the sport in the US, where they have about five US championships every year for their random distances and things like that. It's bonkers. So anyway, that's pretty much it, isn't it, mate? Before we get into Adam Spencer, not much to preview as well. Obviously, like Matt mentioned at the start, European champs going on at the moment. So yeah, just before we move on to Adam, obviously, I'm sure people listen. Ronis Cabruto's had a 6-year ban for kind of performance enhancing drugs. Obviously, he's still got the 10K record on the road, or former world record holder for 10K. On the road, trained under the legendary coach, Brother Colm, who obviously famously coached David Rudisha as well. So pretty alarming stuff, but at the same time, not something we've kind of not, I guess, we've come accustomed to it in the past few years, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what is he, 24 years old and, yeah, busted for EPO. They kind of suspected that with his biological passport, abnormal numbers and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's too good to be true. That 26:46, I think he ran on the road, something around there. And this was in
old shoes as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is 2020, I think, in those little slipper Adidas shoes with some OG Boost foam on them. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, there you go. There you have it. And it's kind of... Yeah, I always think because, yeah, he ran a performance like that, but he did perform sort of okay on the track and stuff. And we would see him in some road races kind of back it up, but he was not that consistent of a runner for me. And yeah, so there you have it. And it just, when he is training under someone like Brother Colm as well, like that is a bit of a shock. That the coach, we can only suspect that he had no idea that Ronis Kipruto was doing it. But there you go. That is a very, very big Kenyan name busted. So it doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. But I think, yeah.
We've had some big names busted this year. Like Mokatir, this man. Like it does make, like you do start to think, well, there's been a lot of high profile endurance runners busted this year, so kind of athletes in and around that figure who you suspect, chances are kind of our instincts have been right.
That's it, isn't it? And then you've just got to look at kind of a lot of the athletes around the circuit as well, and it does make you
does make you wonder how many of these are clean, because look, we talk about the performances over recent years, even over the past 5 years. And I think the timing of the shoes with maybe, I don't know, would it be if you were a doping athlete, would it be a good time to have a bit of an upsurge in what you're doing, take more risks? Because everyone's expecting these big jumps and everyone's sort of talking about shoes and wave lights and things like that. But actually, so these performances don't look so kind of crazy. Whereas, like, take Mokatir's case, for example. I think if the shoe thing hadn't happened and Mokatir made the jump, obviously there were people who were skeptical all along, okay? But I think being skeptical of everyone all the time, it just ruins the sport. There's no point watching it at all. But, like, if you took purely his jumps and then people aren't talking about shoe tech, wave lights, training advancements, whatever, then more people are surprised. But it's a difficult time.
I mean, and there was a kid, that wasn't there, like a 17-year-old kid in high school? But the 100-meter runner, his name slipped my mind, but he's been busted. And this kid ran like, you know, 10 flat or maybe just a bit quicker. This big superstar high school sprinter, he's been busted for drugs. And I'm just thinking, I just wonder if you actually go digging and go looking at kind of how to source, how to take these drugs, whether it's probably a lot easier than you would imagine. Because, it's a bit concerning, really, that like a high schooler has been done.
Yeah, there was that... documentary, wasn't there, like ages ago now, the guy did it for cycling.
Oh, Icarus, mate. Yeah. Obviously, that was like a whole nother level, mate. He's getting tangled up in like the Russians and the doping system there. But like, I'm just talking like on a small, you know, just getting a few pills to kind of pump up some testosterone and stuff like that. Like, it's probably quite easy to do. Not that we're encouraging anyone, but it just, yeah.
No, I think there's more risk, isn't there, doing it on a personal, like obviously the safety thing, whereas some of these athletes clearly feel like very comfortable doing it on like an institutional level, you know, so not good, not good for the sport. Well, yeah, it's not good for the sport that we're seeing so many high profile, but they are catching some of them. And I know people will always say, yeah, but they're not catching enough. Like, there's always more to be caught, but like, at least they are catching some and people are getting like a proper ban. Like, obviously I think me and you have said before, we've always said like, it should be for life, but 6 years at least is a pretty hefty chunk. Whereas sometimes we see kind of your 1, 2, 3, 4 years, for example, where you're sort of like, well, I mean, if they're allowed to just go and train on those off years and come back, then it's not really done much, have you? But yeah, 6 years, 6 years actually a pretty hefty one for once. So that's good to see.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, let's get stuck into catching up with Adam then.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as we said before, hopefully when you're listening, he's the NCAA champ. But even if he's second or third, or all American, great achievement nonetheless, and a great person to talk to, because he's navigating kind of trying to run Australian champs at a weird time of year. Obviously, big goal of going to the Olympics, and that 3:31 PB that he ran in London last year definitely puts him in good stead to go and do that. So we'll let you listen to Adam. Thanks very much for listening to us, and we'll catch you very soon.
Okay, first off, Adam, just welcome to the podcast, mate. How are you? It's great to have you on.
Good. I'm in Arkansas at the moment. We've got NCAA regionals at the moment. So, yeah, not going well. Pretty warm down here.
Yeah. And how are you feeling about regionals, mate?
Yeah, feeling good. It's actually my least favorite meet of the year because it's pretty stressful. Like, I know I should make nationals, but you've still got to actually do it. And we're in a pretty good region. So I've got to get top five in my heat. And yeah, but I feel pretty good. Hopefully it's not too hot, but...
Jeez, man, fair play. When's the race then? So you're in the hotel, sort of getting ready, I guess. When do you start? Is it Wednesday? Gets underway.
Yeah. So it's Monday now. First round's on Wednesday and the Second round is on Friday. So, yeah, got a bit of time.
Would you wish they had a system like that for the pros? For the Olympics?
What do you mean?
Well, for the Olympic Games or something similar? World like, champs, instead of this world ranking, do you wish you could go to a qualifying, like a pre-worlds to qualify?
Like honestly, yeah. I think it's, yeah, because, I mean, qualifying for worlds is all about times and getting the right race, but sometimes the race, like, it's just completely different when you put on the start line with, like, these different guys. And, yeah, I prefer just having a normal race than comparing how fast you've run compared to everyone else. So.
Mm. And I guess, like, regional is quite a tough place for you to be. Like, I guess you're a heavy favourite to make it to the NCAAs. Do you like racing in those sort in that sort of environment, or would you rather just get it over and done with, get to the NCAAs where you're racing for the top prize?
Yeah, I'd rather just get to nationals. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of this meet just because it's two races and, you know, they haven't changed the system yet. It's still small queues, so we don't have to, it's not like top six, it's top five and then the next two fastest. So, you know, there's a bit of luck in which heat you get and who's in your heat and if someone takes it out fast. But yeah, looking forward to just getting through this week and then hopefully get through to Eugene and then really focus on that.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely, man. You're always in a pretty strange position because just, I guess, a bit of background for the people listening. Whenever we speak to kind of Brits who are in the NCAA system, they sort of kind of have to come back after the NCAAs and then try and have a season. Whereas, look, you're already the Aussie champ over 1,500 meters and now you've had to kind of go back to the NCAA, see out your college season and then try and kind of go to the Olympics and stuff like that. How does it feel kind of having that sort of setup in your year?
Yeah, it's definitely a long year. I mean, it starts off in indoors in January, and then if, you know, I'd go over to Europe, it's all the way through August, September. So it's about 6 months of pretty good running, even 7-8 months. But the Aussie champs line up pretty well with my season. I had indoor nationals in March, and then it was only a month later there was Aussie nationals. So, yeah, just flew back, and it did blend in. Yeah, it is a long season. I've got to get through this first and then after that, you know, have a few weeks and gear up for a big European season. But I did it last year and it worked out well last year. And, you know, I mean, there's always talk about like having with long seasons, you know, burning out when you race a lot for months on end. And but last year went well and I felt like I had a lot to give towards June, July and August. And yeah, I mean, the main goal is the Olympics and trying to run well there, but I've still got to run well at this meet too. So, yeah.
So how do you do that? How do you kind of keep that level for several months? It's not even just kind of, you don't have the luxury of just peaking for July, August, you know, 8 week block, maybe a 12 week block. You are peaking kind of almost for 6 months of the year. And how do you do that? What does training look like to be able to do that?
Yeah. So we keep training pretty high throughout the season. It does come down for the big races like nationals and, but still relatively high. I run about 120 kilometers a week, which is about 75 miles. I don't know what you guys use, but yeah, 75 miles, 120 kilometers. And yeah, I'm on Strava and most weeks you say it'll be up around there, but it'll come down for, you know, if we travel quite a bit, it'll dip down a little bit, but I still try to keep it quite high. And yeah, I mean, it is a long season, but you know, towards the big races where I want to run well, I'll be on the track a little bit more. And then, you know, coming off those races, I'll get into training that's a bit more aerobic and a bit, you know, longer and more threshold type work. And, but yeah, I mean, it seems to work. You know, some people really taper for these big events, but I still keep my mileage pretty high for those races. And I think that sort of helps you like carry through the season.
I was going to say, do you have a period, guessing that cross season for you where the mileage is higher, or do you just kind of keep it steady all year and touch base with that 1500 work all year as well?
Yeah, I mean, during cross country season, it was a little bit high, maybe a couple of weeks in the 130s and high 120s. So about, yeah, 80 miles a week, but not significantly higher. But I can just, you know, during cross country, I can do 80 mile weeks for, you know, 8 weeks in a row. But during track season, you know, when you have those big races, you got to come down a little bit. So yeah, I'm not really a guy who does, you know, massive miles in the fall or anything. And during that cross country season, but it's still pretty high. And the workouts are a bit different. Like the sessions in cross country will be, you know, a lot longer. We'll do like 8 mile tempos and stuff like that, but not really doing that much volume this time of year. But, you know, sometimes we'll still go out to a trail and do some longer threshold work, but probably not quite as long as it would be in the cross country season.
Yeah, for sure. And you're obviously coached by Mick Byrne out in Wisconsin, known for kind of his strength training, really. Was he one of the reasons you decided to go out there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main reasons was Ollie Hall and Morgan McDonald. They had done really well with Mick, and obviously Jackson Sharp had done really well, and that's caught my attention. And yeah, I just had a chat with him, and training seemed pretty similar to what it was back home. And yeah, it suits me really well, I think, just his way of training. It is a lot of strength work, but we also do touch on speed quite a bit. And, you know, I've done quite a few 800s, and I've improved over 800 in the past few years. So yeah, we do some pretty good speed work as well, but it is also pretty strength based. So it's a good combination. I think it suits me, and you end up doing pretty well for 1500s because you need good strength and you also need good speed. So
Did you discuss with Ollie and Morgan before, and they put you in touch with Byrne? Did it work like that, or did you just reach straight out to Wisconsin? Was that it? Just one decision, one uni that you wanted to go to?
Yeah, so I sent a lot of emails to different schools and they didn't all reply, but Wisconsin was one of the ones that actually reached out. And then I spoke to them first, and then they put me in touch with Ollie and Morgan. So during the recruiting process, when I was talking to other schools, you know, they sent me up with Morgan and Ollie, and yeah, I had a really good conversation with them, and they were just talking about everything, about how they liked Madison and how they liked the training and everything. And they had really good things to say about it. And so they really helped with my decision to go to Wisconsin. But at the end of the day, it was still, I wanted to be trained by Mick and wanted to be around the guys on the team. So yeah, it wasn't just them that got me over the line, but they were like a factor in the decision of going to Wisconsin.
It's funny because when we had the Wheeler boys on, they said Mick was really good with international students, like foreign students as well, because Americans are a bit soft. Did you say his name?
He's Irish, so with Brits and Irish and the Australians, he gets along well with us, and yeah, he's a good laugh. He definitely says things that he shouldn't. That's what we like about him. So yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, and you've seen big improvements since you've gone to Wisconsin, like particularly last year, and we'll obviously chat about that. But what sort of level were you at before you went out there?
Yeah, so about when I finished high school, I hadn't run anything too crazy. I'd run about 3:54 for the 1500 and 1:52 or 1:51 for the 800. And, you know, you've got to be in that 1:49 or 3:45 type sort of times to actually get a full scholarship to a big school. And so I actually did a year back home, and it was during COVID as well, so I just had to stay home. And yeah, and I had a pretty big improvement in that COVID year. Got my times down to 3:39 and 1:49, so that was a big jump for me that year. And so I came into college as a 3:39 and 1:49 guy.
Let's talk about that jump there. For instance, like in that COVID year, what were you doing to make that jump?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just stepping away from school. You know, I think the education system in the UK is pretty similar. You know, you've got your HSE exams, is that like, or A-levels, what do you call them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, A-levels.
Yeah, so it's pretty similar. It's like you've got to do well in year 11 and 12 to get into a good uni. And that was a big focus for me, was doing well in school. And I thought I was training a lot, but looking back on it, I really was not training that much at all. And I think that kind of worked in my favor, just because once I finished school, I was able to focus on running quite a bit. And my coach, Tim O'Shaughnessy, who grew and trained with as well, I credit a lot of my success to him. And yeah, we just hit about 50 miles a week, 80 Ks a week, just week on end. On Tuesday would be on the track and just hit about 8K volume, and then Thursday would be a threshold or Friday would be a threshold. And yeah, I just did that for months on end, and I hadn't had that much training before. And yeah, we didn't have any races because Melbourne, we were in lockdown for ages. The whole year was just covered, and we had a 5K radius. We weren't allowed to leave that, which was just yeah, pretty crazy. But once we were able to finally race, I was actually, yeah, dropped down to 354 to 345. So that was just a big difference in having actual real training behind me. And yeah, that was a big jump. And so COVID, yeah, I know that screwed a lot of people over, but for me, it actually worked in my favor.
It's funny because already then when you're touching on like those consistent 50s that you were hitting, and now obviously that's higher at Wisconsin, but I guess you came through that MTC like youth group, right?
Yeah.
And where they train similar to Nick Bedeau. And again, that's a very consistent method of training, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we train pretty similar to how they train. It's, yeah, when I was younger, I was able to, you know, be running with Stewie and Brett Roms and Ryan Gregson. And yeah, I wouldn't be able to keep up with them in the sessions, but towards the end, we'd, you know, if they do some fast 400s, I'd just tag on the back of them and try to hang on. But just seeing how they were able to train and, yeah, keep it, you know, they're very consistent year in, year out, and they keep their mileage pretty high. And so, yeah, I was very lucky to be surrounded by that group. And yeah, a lot of those values I still carry with me today.
Well, yeah, so it sounds like there doesn't seem to be too much periodization in the way that you grew up training in Australia and now obviously the way that Mick coaches you as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, when I was younger, I didn't do a lot of speed work. I mean, every now and then we'd do, you know, one really hard workout. I remember the hardest one we did was 300-400s off a 4 or 5 minute cycle. And by the end, I'm just hitting, you know, in so much lactic, I can barely get off the ground for about 30 minutes. But that was honestly pretty rare. It was, you know, back in Melbourne, it was a lot of aerobic work. You know, Tuesday would be, you know, 8x K on the grass, and then Thursday would be threshold, and Saturday would be hills, and Sunday we'd go out to like this place called Fernie Creek, which is, you get quite a lot of elevation there. It's really hilly, and yeah, it's not as much periodization, but now I'd say there is a little bit more. Like, we're on the track more than I would be in Melbourne. I'd say we'd do sort of race specific workouts, and you know, like this past Tuesday, I just did sets of 400, 300, 200. And with the 200s, we get, you know, we'd be working really fast in the last 100, like pick it up the last 100 and then just smack the last 50. So, yeah, I've done a bit more of that work now at Wisconsin. But, yeah, I mean, there is definitely some level of periodization. But when you're racing so much, you've got to keep it pretty high throughout most part of the year.
Yeah, and let's chat about London Diamond League last year, because obviously we mentioned the improvements kind of before going to college in America, but 336 down to 331 in one race. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that was a bit of a shock to me and everyone else, but I knew a big PB was coming. I didn't think it was gonna be that big though, so I'd run 336 in Finland a few weeks before. And yeah, I'd just come off the plane. I was supposed to get to Europe about a week before that race, but I was leaving the 4th of July weekend. So there were lots of, and there was bushfires as well. So my plane was cancelled and ended up getting to Finland. I got to the UK a day before I was going to Finland. And so about 2 days before the race, I arrived in Europe. And so I was a little bit jet lag, and it was a bit windy that day. And I just knew it wasn't perfect conditions, but I'd still run 336. So I knew I had a 334 in me, but that Diamond League race, you know, when you just tag on the back and you don't even look at the clock, you just sort of hang in with those guys for as long as you can. And I remember I crossed the line and looked up at the scoreboard and I thought I'd run the world standard, which was 334 at the time, I think, but I didn't think I'd run through. And yeah, that was a big surprise, but I mean, I want to be able to back it up again because I've only done it once. But, you know, hopefully I'll get another opportunity to be in a fast race this year and, yeah, run something similar. But, yeah, that was a massive jump. But, yeah, it didn't feel like a 331, that's for sure.
Did it not? You didn't, like, during the race and stuff, you didn't even feel like you were going that fast?
No, I actually went out pretty slow. My first 800 was about 155. So I knew didn't think I was going to be running 331. And I think I went through the bell in about 237. So in my head, I was like, all right, if I close into 57, I'll run 334. And I was obviously pretty tired off the race, but just, yeah, I didn't think it was a 331, that's for sure.
And it's funny how the sport works, isn't it? Because there's been, you know, various articles which have documented, you got a call up, what, the night before? Is that true? Who gave you a call to say you're in the London Diamond League and why as well? How did you get in there so late?
Yeah, so Nick Bedeau, who's the agent and coach of MTC, I've known him for years, and he was helping me set up a European season. He said, "Hey, Diamond League's on the cards. You might be able to, you know, run in London." And I said, "Oh, that's pretty cool." But he said, "You know, it's a long shot. Like, be patient. Like, I can't guarantee I'll get you in." And the start list came out on, I think, a few days before on the Wednesday, and I think the race was on Sunday, and my name wasn't on it. And he's, and in, you know, it's like, well, I've got to go run this British Miles Club in Tooting instead. And, you know, I was pretty disappointed because I had my hopes up and I was pretty excited. And then, yeah, literally the day before at 5:30, I was just with my girlfriend. We're in London, you know, went to Buckingham Palace, we're in Leicester Square at the time, I think. And I got a call from Nick and he's like, "Yeah, you're in the London Diamond League race. Like, do you want to have a run?" And yeah, I mean, you know, walking around London the day before, and I did a hard session 2 days before the race, and I thought, oh, it's not ideal preparation, but you know, this may be the only time I can actually get into this sort of race. So I said, all right, let's go do it. So I had to, I think I was drinking tea and I had to stop that and go to get an Uber to the stadium and stay at the hotel. And yeah, I hadn't run that day. I was planning to take a day off, and I had to go for a jog and do some strides, like a little pre-meet. And yeah, it happened very fast, but yeah, I only got the call up the night before, which was, yeah, pretty hectic.
Jesus, has that taught you to be like really relaxed going into races now? Like, surely that gives you a lot of confidence if things aren't going your way. And like you said, you have a rough travel or you just feel a bit knackered, like you just don't have to stress.
Yeah, I mean, it taught me that you don't have to have the perfect, you know, pre-race superstitions, or you don't have, not everything has to go right. I mean, yeah, I was walking around quite a bit the day before, and usually the day before race, I would just sit in the hotel for the most part of the day. So yeah, your preparation doesn't have to be perfect, but I think it helped my mindset as well. You know, it's like, well, if it doesn't go well, you know, you haven't had the best lead up into this, but you know, you got to take a crack and seize the opportunity. So yeah, it worked out well. And yeah, learn a lot about, you know, preparing for meets, and yeah, not everything has to go all your way.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, obviously, we mentioned earlier kind of the unique circumstances of the NCAA, but back in the day, if people were running those sorts of times, they'd perhaps consider kind of exiting college and just going pro straight away. Is that something that you considered at all? But obviously, with things like Neil deals that we want to speak to you about as well, is that kind of changing, you think, in the NCAA?
Yeah, I think, yeah, the NIL deal is really sort of bridge that gap. You know, yeah, if you're running 331 a few years ago, you'd probably just be going pro and focusing on Worlds. But yeah, I've got an NIL deal with Nike, and that allows me to, you know, represent them and get some money as well while I can still stay in college. And, you know, I was thinking about going pro just because, you know, what's the point of running NCAAs when you're trying to fully prepare for Worlds and the Olympics? But I think going through the NCAA system actually helps me prepare for those races. I think just having that experience, and, you know, I still didn't win the indoor mile and might not even win the outdoor title. It'll be a tough one to win, but it's good preparation, and I still get to train with Mick and, you know, live in Madison, Wisconsin and finish off my degree. So yeah, NIL has been really good, and it's allowed me to stay in college for a bit longer. And yeah, I'll probably do another year still after this, but we'll see how the summer is. But at this rate, I'll probably still stay in college for another year or so.
Oh, wow. Yeah, man, that NCAA mile was a scrappy one as well, wasn't it, for you? But yeah, these nil deals, they are interesting. You've obviously signed one now as well. Like, are you actually like profiting from it? Which is kind of what they were made for, wasn't it? So you can actually pocket if someone uses your photo or I don't know, anything like that, right? Do you want to just explain it a little bit more and explain actually how you benefit from it?
Yeah, so it's similar to a pro deal, but so I do earn like a set income and like salary, but I can't have any bonuses. So a professional contract, you know, you can have if you run the national record or win a Diamond League or win Worlds or whatever it is, you know, you can get bonuses. But with NIL deals, you can't. You've got to have a set salary. And it becomes even more tricky because I'm an international student. So my US visa, I can't actually earn any money. So the Nike deal has to go through my Australian bank account, and I can't actually post anything while I'm in the US. So I can't post, you know, photos with Nike and tag them when I'm in the US, because technically that means you're earning money, which violates your student visa, which is all a bit stupid because you're going to be doing the same thing in Australia. But yeah, that's in essence how it works.
Wow, that's really weird. I thought it was like you just got bonuses if someone uses, you know, your images and stuff like that. But you are actually on like a salary then. So, and I guess is this Nike's way of kind of grabbing you? So and it's a cool position for you to be in, because it's basically a safety net that when you do graduate college, I mean, what happens there? Like, are you does the contract get evaluated the minute you graduate?
Yeah. So I don't know how much detail I can go into, but I'm pretty sure I can say this stuff. So once you graduate, once I finish my eligibility, the contract ends, but they still have the first right of refusal, which means if any other company were to offer a deal, they have the right to match that, and then I have to go with them. So I think that's sort of the main reason why they're getting in the athletes' doors, is just to have that first right of refusal. And but yeah, it does finish once you either graduate or you just say, I'm done with college, I want to go pro. Mm-hmm. So it is a different contract once I hopefully eventually go professional.
Mm-hmm. This obviously was something that I think it would have come in like while you were at uni. So obviously before you went to college, these weren't a thing. Is it something that you saw as a big improvement?
Sorry, what was that? NIL, do you mean?
I was just thinking, like, in terms of the timing, I'm pretty sure they're not that old, are they? So like you weren't at college when kind of NIL deals became a thing.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure when they introduced it, but I think it was about when I went over. But mm-hmm. obviously that was sort of targeted towards football and basketball because there's so much money there. And, you know, those NIL deals are worth, you know, the top quarterbacks at the big schools really? Are making millions of dollars. It's ridiculous. But that was sort of the main focus because, you know, basketball and football and baseball and all that are sort of the big sports in the NCAA. But I think there was sort of a delayed effect with track and field. I think Charles Hicks was probably one of the first guys to get an NIL deal, and he got that after winning his national cross country in 2022. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, there's been a lot. There's quite a lot of people who have got NIL deals now, but I think it took a while for sort of people to understand it and what you could do with it. But now the ball's really rolling, and yeah, lots of people have got NIL deals in track and field, which is good to see. But yeah, very lucky with the timing, because I think it only really came up in the past year or so.
Yeah, scary to think how many, I mean, we're obviously interested in the distance running world and how many distance runners who, yeah, over the past 6 months have announced one of those deals. I mean, one thing I want to ask you is, what's been the like direct impact for you? Obviously, bar like you've got some extra money flying around that when you're in college, you might not need as such. But yeah, what's been the impact like? Are you just dashing that money away, saving it, or are you kind of investing it? Is it leveling your performance up in any way? Have you got extra support?
I've just invested all of it at the moment. Just putting it into
crypto or something, right?
not crypto. No. I study finance, so I understand that you shouldn't be putting all your money into that. But yeah, just sort of index funds and just chipping away at some certificate deposits as well, and yeah, just keeping it away. But it also helps me with going over to Europe. You know, flights aren't cheap, and going home, and you know, this year we went to some of the guys went to Albufeira in Portugal, and that money sort of went towards that as well. So yeah, it's been pretty helpful, but a lot of it I've been investing. So yeah,
that's a good point. So that's going to kind of fund your season post the NCAAs as well.
Yeah, I was pretty lucky last year. The school, because I represented Wisconsin, the school was able to cover that. But because I'm representing Nike, the school can't cover it anymore. But yeah, that'll go towards this year. I don't know if I'm going to go on an altitude camp or anything like that. But I might. And if I do, that money will go towards that. So yeah, very fortunate to be in that position.
Mm. Yeah, and when you're in Europe, kind of chasing that pro season after college, I presume obviously you're still coach with Mick, but how does that coaching relationship work kind of when you're over in Europe?
Yeah, so he's actually, yeah, he stayed in the US last year, and we did a race. We went to Morton Games in Dublin. He's actually from Dublin. I can't remember the name of the track, but wherever Morton Games is held, that was his club. I think it's Clonhill Farriers or something like that. But he ran for that club, and he knows the guy who runs Morton pretty well, so he came down for that. But otherwise, I would just be mainly training by myself. You know, he'll give me a weekly log of what I should do, and it gives me the splits, which is usually a bit different because, in Madison, he'll just be like, "All right, meet us at the track at this time," and I'll tell you the workout once you get there. So it's a bit different knowing the sessions beforehand, but it worked well last year. I mean, sometimes training by yourself can be a good thing because you're not caught up in, trying to keep up with anyone else. You just really go your own pace and go your own feel. So, but I do prefer training with other people. I think it's a lot better to have guys to warm up with, cool down with, and do the session with. But I went to there were we had a before Budapest, we had a training camp in Montpellier, the south of France, and I was able to train with some guys there, but still, with mixed stuff, it's pretty unique. So I tried to mix and match with other guys, but I was still doing quite a bit of training on my own. But I had for the easy runs and the warm-ups, I had people to train with, so that was nice.
Yeah, and I just want to talk about obviously, the NCAAs is coming up. No doubt you want to go for the win there. But just clarify that Australian selection policy for us, because when you won the Australian Championships, and obviously you got the standard from the previous year, I was like, oh, right, that's the Aussie team selected. Then you read a little bit more into it, because I was like, oh, someone like McSwain's going to miss out and Cam Myers. But yeah, you read more into it. It's just down to selectors, right?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. So there's basically two waves of selection. There's one right after nationals, and then there's one at the end of the period in the first week of July once, the selection period's over. So to be eligible for the first wave, there's I think there was three criteria. You had to finish top two at nationals. You had to have the time before or at nationals, like the Olympic standard. And then you had to compete at a domestic race, so that was the Sydney Track Classic or the Camp Albie Thomas Mile. So that was one of the things I hadn't done. But even I actually emailed the selectors beforehand and I said, because I was tossing up whether it was gonna be worth it to come back early for the Sydney Track Classic or do a race there so I can tick that box. But I said, even if you come back and go run it. Run in Sydney and you win and you have the time, we can't guarantee selection. So yeah, that's why I didn't go back and do that. But so I essentially knew I wasn't going to be picked just because I hadn't fulfilled that domestic race criteria. But they also said that even if I did do that, it wouldn't be a guarantee. I mean, it's a tricky one because April's it's yeah, lots of people are saying I should be picked, but at the same time, April's pretty early in the year. There's a lot can happen between April and August. With you guys, you have your nationals in what, June, right? So that's a bit closer. People are in form then, and but it is a tricky one. But yeah, if I keep form and run well, and I should be okay. But I guess I'll find out in July.
Does that make nationals a little bit not pointless, because you're still the Australian national champion now, but yeah, you would prefer to kind of have more riding on it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a tricky one because if you really want to value nationals and if you want the guys who are training and living overseas to come back, you've got to place, quite a bit of value on nationals. But yeah, so I think it'll help a lot. They do weigh quite a bit, but also they can't guarantee selection. So yeah, it's a tricky one.
And you'll only find out if you're going to Paris, what, end of June, like everyone else? Or like,
Yeah, I think they
yeah.
announced the team first week of July, yeah, or end of June. So yeah.
And is there any kind of tricky little clauses in that selection policy for that second one? Are there any kind of ambiguous ones in there?
Not that I know of. I hope not, but I haven't picked up on anything. But I guess I'll have an idea depending on how the other guys race. I mean, if there's three or four guys who run 3:30 or quicker, I'm probably gonna have to go out and run something pretty fast. But if they if they don't run, you know, 331, 332, and then I might be good. So I'll have a bit more of an idea depending on how they race in the next few weeks.
Yeah. And another thing I was going to ask you about, we mentioned what a nil deal has done for you personally, but, you know, I feel like the NCAA has moved on, not just performance wise in the last 10 years, but is there other stuff going on in the NCAA now that you guys have got access to that perhaps they didn't? Like, are they helping you with supplements? Is their physiology improving? Like, are you getting tested and stuff more regularly in the NCAA? Because these are things that 10 years ago, I don't think was happening, but I might be wrong there.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't think that's... I think NIL deals are the only thing that the university involved in that. It's more sort of outside. But yeah, I mean, in terms of access to facilities and all that sort of thing, I think it's pretty similar. No, I get a massage, you know, once every few weeks, and but I think I've always had that and had access to physios. And yeah, don't think much has changed, to be honest, but... yeah, maybe that's something I'm not too sure about.
Yeah, I didn't know if different programs were, like, you know, going into detail on a lot more things. I mean, you look at the way NAU are performing. But
yeah,
it sounds like McBurn's still old school, still just, you know, doing what he's doing.
I know a lot of schools are doing the double threshold and double workout things, and that's something I've seen that at least, you know, 90% of schools have experimented with. And some are doing really well off it. Obviously, NAU do it, and they've had great success. So we've dabbled in that a bit. Not sure if I'm fully sold on it. I haven't done it a whole lot, but, I mean, I do enjoy it because you do a session in the morning and you have an excuse to do absolutely nothing for the rest of the day. You can just eat and sleep and, you know, you don't feel too guilty about it. So I don't mind that part of it, but I don't know how much it helps the training, but... I mean, I understand the concept behind it, but that's another thing that's probably changed in the past few years, that schools are doing that more.
Yeah, and then obviously we mentioned kind of your qualification for the Olympics, like you're still waiting to find out, but provided you go, and we obviously wish you all the best of that. What's the aim this year? Like, how do you go one better than a semi-final last year?
Yeah, the real goal would be to make the final. I was pretty disappointed last year. I mean, the heats was really good and I ran well in that, but, you know, coming to the semi-final, I was probably just a bit cooked. I mean, the turnaround was less than 24 hours. So I think we raced the round one at about 7 p.m. and then 5 p.m. the next day was the semi-final. And, you know, the round one in my head was sort of, you know, the round where I had to perform at my best. You know, I had to run 3:34 to make it, and I wanted to have at least two runs. And yeah, it was really hot in Budapest as well. Like, I struggled with heat quite a bit, especially on the second day because it was a little bit earlier, the sun was out a little bit, but just performing back to back at that level, I think I just couldn't handle. And but the goal would be to make the final. I mean, yeah, if you're on 3:32 or 3:31 in the semis, you know, you have a good chance of making the final. And you know, if I had that race I did in London in the semi-final, you know, maybe I would have made the final. So, making the final will be a big goal, but I've got to work on, you know, going through those rounds and competing at that level back-to-back.
Man, have you checked the timetable? Is it similar? I mean, yeah, so in Budapest, I'm right, I'm thinking like the heat was in the evening and the semis were in the morning the following day, right?
No, it wasn't in the morning. It was about, 7 p.m. for the round one and the next day, 5 p.m. And then they took 2 days off and then the final.
Right. Is it going to be the same in Paris?
Yeah, so Paris is day on, day off, day on, day off. So it's, heat. And then the day off, but they're doing this this new thing where you, like, if you don't make the semi-final, I think, like, the fastest losers chance. Forgot what you call it. I want to say rapid.
Yeah, repercharge, well, repercharge round or whatever it is.
Something like that, yeah. I don't understand it fully. I don't know how many people go to that round and I don't know how many people come out of it, but they're doing... Yeah, so they do the round one and the next day they do that repercharge round or whatever you call it. And then the semi-final and then a day off and then the final. So I think the day off in between races helps quite a bit.
Massively. Mate, God, I remember when they released that and I didn't think it was going to come into play in Paris. I thought this was like a thing way off in the future. I can't believe they're actually going to do that. So, I mean, I guess everyone has to consider that they might have to do. I wonder if anyone will make all four races. Some will end up in that repechage round and actually go on to make the final.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm not sure how many people actually go through. I was told that it was just the fastest loser. So instead of the small queues, they just put them in the round. But someone told me it's a way for everyone to get two races in. But yeah, I really don't know how it works. But it'll be interesting. Yeah, I mean, there might be some people who end up going to that round and they make the finals. They got four races. But yeah, interesting to see how it works.
I guess it stops people like falling over and getting put through to semis and finals now. That tactic's out the window, so they'll have to
Adam Fogg do that one, you know. And it worked for him. And a couple of Australia worked for Stewie and Matt Ramsden at the Worlds as well. They're a lot more strict in the NCAA. There's a couple of guys who fell in the indoor mile, and there's a good guy called Isaac Basson who's been pretty competitive, and he's gotten second in the indoor mile before, and they didn't let him through, which I thought was a bit unlucky. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's what some people do, just fall over and make it through the next round. So it's not a bad thing falling over, I guess.
That definitely happens. You're right. But now those NCAA officials, man, they've always been hot. I remember when they DQ'd Westie a few years ago in the 1500 for Fogg starting at region was actually one of our 1500 boys. Yeah, so he was like, I think he was NCAA record holder at the time. Maybe he'd run 336 or 5. And he was at Oregon. And he Fogg started at regionals and they just DQ'd him straight away. Like, it was one of those ones where you just get a bit nervous, you know?
Lucky that I Fogg started at outdoors last year. I ended up getting third. And I don't know if I saw, I was a bit shaky on the line. My foot definitely went over. But yeah, lucky I didn't get the score like that. Yeah, Mick would have killed me for that one.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, anyway, Adam, it's been great to chat to you, mate. And we wish you all the best for regionals this weekend and then, of course, the rest of the season as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.